Hello, we are on. So, testing 1, 2, 3. I haven't done this in a while, so I'm not very sure if I am being currently broadcasted, but I believe that I am. That says a lot about the quality of this show, so I would like to apologize in advance. So, we are going to be talking about a very touchy, feely subject, a subject that people believe has been a conflict for decades, in centuries, in millenniums, but it's actually very, very recent. And I would just like to say, as a precursor, if I offend you by my perspective, if this is a touchy, feely kind of subject to you, then please click off, because I will not apologize for my opinions. I will not apologize for the things that I believe in, and I will not fall victim to the narrative of anti-Semitism, and we will go into depth as to exactly what that is and what that means and how Israel uses that as a ploy to control Palestinians and Palestinian activists from speaking out and critiquing the government. So, let's talk about first about anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is real, anti-Semitism exists, and it is wrong, and in no way do I believe in anti-Semitism. And it's so sad that in this day and age, I have to say something like that, because, oh, I understand what the problem is. I'm wearing the wrong speakers. Am I? I'm so sorry, you guys. Anyways, I'm not wearing the wrong speakers. Anti-Semitism is real and it exists, and it's so sad that in this day and age, anyone who would like to critique Israel has to have that and has to apologize for it. We'll go into depth later about Ilhan and Mark Lamont and Angela Davis and other people who have had to apologize and say the same things, but I'll just have to put it out there because there will be someone who is going to condemn me for being anti-Semitic. So, what is anti-Semitism? Anti-Semitism is hostility to, prejudice, or discrimination against Jewish people or Jews. And it is something that exists, and it's something that is going and that is happening, and it is something that is really sad and should not be happening. So, when we talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we are not discussing an ethnic situation. It's not Arabs versus Jews. It is an issue of settler colonialism and apartheid. So it is political, it is geographic, it isn't ethnic. And let's understand why it is that way and why the narrative of it being ethnic and it being Arabs versus Jews is wrong. So we are going to go into the history of Palestine and how it has come to what it is today. So let us go to the early 19th century, 1897, and this is the beginning of the Zionist movement. So, the Zionist movement was a political movement that aimed to establish a Jewish homeland for the Jewish people, because they didn't have one and they were just kind of scattered over Europe and other areas. There's Jews in Morocco, there's Jews in Africa, and blah, 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 blah. So they were like, we need to find a country. So Britain proposed a bunch of countries. So some of them were Kenya, some were Uganda, British Guyana, which is now Guyana, was also proposed. But those were all not taken in account because the Jewish people felt like they deserved more. They wanted something holy. They wanted something that they could have some form of belonging or bond to. So that is when Palestine was recommended and suggested. And at the time, it was the fall of the Ottoman Empire. So Palestine was under the British rule. So, what happened was the Balfour Declaration in 1917, and it was a public pledge by Britain to give a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. And the thing about Britain, is, which is so funny to me, is at the same time, Britain also promised France Palestine, and it also promised the Arab people Palestine under certain conditions, which the Arabs ended up fulfilling. So Britain is a tricky one. I can't believe it. Like, can you imagine? Just you promised 3 different people. It's just funny to me that that happened. Anyways, so the first uproar from or some like a form of condemning of a Jewish homeland in the Palestinian state was surprisingly from Orthodox Jews, because they believe that it went against the teachings in the Torah. As to them it said, and I am not speaking on behalf of them, I'm just speaking as to what they said. Do not want to speak on behalf of a minority group. But they said they believed that they do not, that in the Torah it says that there is not a Jewish homeland for the Jewish people, and that is one of the tests that God has given them. But anyways, so a Jewish home was promised. And it's very important to look at the terminology. Britain promised a home and not a state. The fact that it promised a home left it ambiguous. If it had promised a state, that would indicate sovereignty, and that means that there would have been borders, and it would have been very specific as to where the Jewish state would be and where the Palestinian state would be. But that's not what happened. So it was just a free-for-all, if you think about it that way. And at the time, the Jewish population within Palestine, if we're talking about 1897 or even 1917, was around 3%. So they were promised a home in an area where they were the minority, and 3% at that. So British people have guts. Anyways, so between 1922 and 1935, the Jewish population rose, and it went to almost 27% of the total population. And just kind of going back a little bit, when people say that the Palestinian-Israeli issue is ethnic and it is Arab versus Jews, Jewish people have been living, as we can see, in Palestine harmoniously for centuries. There is a Jewish population in Palestine, and they call themselves Palestinian Jews. So it isn't ethnic at all, it is just geographical and territorial. So later on, this escalated, and what happened was in 1948 was Al-Nakba. And what that was Zionist armed groups forcibly dispelled 750,000 Palestinians out of their homeland. And my family, both from my mother and my father's side, was part of this, and they had to leave and flee and pack up the stuff and pack up everything they'd ever known and ever grown up. They had, because olive trees live for centuries, and when we look back, my dad tells me that there was olive trees that had been there for centuries, and it was just so heartbreaking how the just leaving behind everything, and it's a situation for more than 60 million people today, because there is such a growing refugee crisis. But moving forward, I'll talk about experience as a refugee later on. But the UN later on drew borders in 1947, and from that point, Israel was no longer a homeland, but it was a state. So it was declared a sovereign state. So if you're wondering, okay, well, now we have borders. The UN says that this area is for Palestine and this area is for Israel. What's the big issue? Well, the big issue is illegal settlements and settler colonialism, which is exactly what this is. We're not going to go into depth about this right now, because this is just the history. So basically, to summarize, we'll take a small break, because I understand this is a lot of information to take in. To summarize, in the post-colonial world, in our post-colonial world, it is just upsetting to see a country that promotes colonialism, to think that we've suffered for almost 300 years in such an imbalance of hierarchy, of social hierarchy, and a country like America that supports Israel so much, that claims to be the land of the free and the brave, supporting something like this. And in the words of Edward Said, someone who I absolutely adore and love, Alayhi Hamel, that late Edward Said, may God have peace on his soul, Israel was made by a European power, about a non-European territory in a flat disregard of both the presence and wishes of the native majority resident in that territory. So we will put on a poem by a Palestinian author. She's also from Gaza, and her name is Rafif Ziada, and it kind of answers the question. A lot of people ask this as well, and why are you so angry? Why are you so upset? Why don't you just practice love and just spread happiness? And that discourse is complete and utter bull, and she will explain why. So we will be back, and with less technical difficulties and less confusion. The weather outside is awful. Some people love this weather. I do not. So we apologize that we are late. But we will get back into things. When things go down, things go up. There's always a better side to stuff. So we will be back. And I will leave you with Rafif Ziada. So we continue to have technical difficulties, unfortunately. But we will play something else. And we play Lauryn Hill. And we will be back after Lauryn Hill. Lauryn Hill is as amazing. So there's no apologies there. So Lauryn Hill is not playing either. So what we will do is we will restart the system. We are having technical difficulties. That is life. I apologize, but we will be back in 2 minutes, hopefully.
Our trespasses as we forgive those that trespass against us. I'll load them again, we will never, never, never trust.
We are back, my friends. So there was Lauryn Hill. Things came through, it's working, we're good. Let's go back into settler colonialism, because now we're going to talk about what the real issue in Palestine is. Is it Arabs hating on Jews and being completely anti-Semitic and not wanting a Jewish homeland? No, that is not what is happening, and we're going to discuss why. So, the conflict is often cast as an Arabs versus Jews dispute, and people think it's ethnic and religious differences, but as we have seen in 1917 and in 1897, there was already a Jewish population that was living and thriving in Palestine, and the two have been living harmoniously for decades, centuries actually. And there's also, people don't even realize that there's also a large Christian population as well in Palestine, so it's not Muslim versus Jewish. It is Palestinian versus settler colonial. It is occupied versus occupying. So the colonizer and the colonized. And it's very, very important to make that distinction when we talk about solutions. So we have to understand that the creation of the Jewish homeland is not a Jewish motive. It is a Zionist motive. And when we critique Israel, we critique Zionism and not Judaism. So when we are critiquing Israel, it is not anti-Semitic because it has no correlation to the religion. I want to just repeat that again before we move on, because I am so sick and tired of having to see people apologize for critiquing Israel. I am not going to apologize. And this correlation does not make any sense to me. So just to go back and just rewind. When we talk about Israel, the creation of a Jewish homeland is a Zionist movement. Zionism is political, and you can see that. For example, there is a lot of white American men that are Christian Zionists. And how can that be? Well, it's because Zionism is political. Not religious. So there's no correlation to the religion. So we are critiquing Zionism and not Judaism. And then, so basically the two have become synonymous with each other. And that is because Israel has such a power or a hegemony over media, over violence, over surveillance, with over militarization, over territory. So that control and that power that Israel has, it has the power to cast anyone in any light that it wants to. So the strength that it has today has tied in the fact that Judaism is Zionism, and it is not. So it is not anti-Semitic to critique Israel's policy. It's not anti-Semitic to critique Zionism. It's not anti-Semitic to be against settler colonialism or apartheid. So when what happens when we focus on anti-Semitism, and everyone's afraid, I was even afraid for a while to speak out, is that you shed away from the actual issue, which is contemporary settler colonialism. And when we want to solve the conflict, if we're focusing on ethnic conflict and religious conflict, we'll get to nowhere, because that's not the root issue. The UN has drawn lines for Israel. Whether or not, I'm not talking about two-state solution, I'm not talking about a one-state solution, I'm not talking about the legitimacy of Israel being in Palestine in the first place, I'm going to talk about it in a political perspective and leave aside my bias, which is going to be very hard, so I have to put out my bias. I am Palestinian, I am a Palestinian refugee, so I have a very strong connection to Palestine, so when I talk, there will be a bias, no matter how much I believe that there isn't, there will be. So I have to just put that out there in the beginning. So the lines that the UN has drawn for Israel, they completely continue to go against that, and they continue to further their illegal settlements. So just the other day, a man was arrested because he refused to give up his homeland or his house, and they took it and they completely stampeded it, and then they continue to build settlements on it where illegal Israeli immigrants, colonizers, or whatever word have you, live. And I don't think that it is insensitive to use the word colonizer or to use the word settler. Occupier, not gonna apologize again, because that is exactly what it is. If I were to look into the definition of colonialism, if I were to look into the definition of illegal colonization, illegal settlements, apartheid, that would just, the entire situation would be defined by what is happening in Palestine. So again, I'm very unapologetic, unfortunately. So anyways, when we continue to think about, when we call it anti-Semitic, we continue to attach the narrative of anti-Semitism, we take away from the issue. So let's talk about settler colonialism. What is the difference between that? So settler colonialism is not about who you are. So it is about where you are. So when we talk about the colonization of Native Americans, indigenous people, it wasn't about who they were. It was about where they were located geographically. When we talk about slavery, it was about who you were, how you looked. So those two things are different distinctions. So when we're tackling the issue of Palestine-Israel, it is geographical, it is territorial. Sorry, there is just a little bit of buzz in the background of it. So we talk about Palestine-Israel, it is geographical, it is territorial. And what that means is that if it continues to perpetuate, it will just take up more territory. The only way that you are secure within your state is by occupying more territory. And that is exactly what is happening. So when we talk about ceasefires, and we talk about, oh, we want a peaceful Israel-Palestine, we want them to live harmoniously together, you're not addressing the fact that there is square foot of miles of continued territory being taken from, sorry, I get distracted very easily, and I just hear things in the background, and then my mind just drifts. Moving forward, so we take away from the fact that it is settler colonial and is territorial. So I'd just like to give an example, because when people talk about the Jewish homeland, or they talk about Zionism in general, it is very accepted, the term a Jewish homeland, the term a chosen people, And these terminologies frighten me because when anything else is done in the name of religion, it is extremist and it is radical. So if someone were to do this under the name of Islam and Muslims, we would be terrorists. We'd be radical Muslim terrorists. Oh my goodness, could you imagine if Muslims went out into a different country that wasn't theirs and they set up a state? And we said that this was, that we said, first of all, that Muslim people were a chosen people under Shaddaism. We're going to replace Zion with Shadda. So under Shaddaism, I am going to go to blah, 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 blah. I will go to Adele. Give me a country that hasn't been colonized. Let's use colonizer. I will go to France, okay? And I will set up in France and I will eradicate the French people. And I will tell them that there is a historical reference to France, to my people. Before 1000 BC, we had originally lived there. And under Shaddaism, under Islam, and under my religious doctrine, I will come and I will live here and I will set up my own borders and set up my own sovereignty. And I will continue to take more and more and more of land in France. And if you critique me for doing this, oh, at the same time, I'm also committing atrocities against the French people. We're going to talk about that later on, how they're testing on Palestinian prisoners. But if you critique me and you tell me I don't want Shaddaism in France because it violates my basic rights as a human being, I will tell you that you are being Islamophobic and you are going against my religion and you are going against my existence to exist. It just sounds ridiculous when you put that into that perspective. So the accepted narrative of Zionism in the first place is ridiculous. We have to question the narrative within itself, because if any other religion did that, everyone would be up in arms about it. And we'll take a break and we'll review this once we come back, because I know it is a lot to take and my mind races 1,000 miles per minute, and I will come back and we will review this. And now hopefully we can listen to Rafiq Ziyada, because it is honestly so beautiful what she says. So let's cross our fingers and we will be back.
End of the day, so I was practicing my P's all night. I'll start with this poem. I wrote this poem when the bombs were dropping on Gaza, and I was the media spokesperson for the coalition, doing a lot of the organizing. And we had stayed up to about 6 o'clock in the morning, perfecting every soundbite. And by the end, if you're Palestinian, you know most Palestinians get tired and start pronouncing our P's as B's. So we become Palestinians by the end of the day. So I was practicing my P's all night. And the next morning, one of the journalists asked me, "Don't you think it would all be fine if you just stopped teaching your children to hate?" I did not insult the person. I was very polite. But I wrote this poem as a response to these types of questions we Palestinians always get. Today, my body was a TV'd massacre. Today, my body was a TV'd massacre that had to fit into sound bites and word limits. Today, my body was a TV'd massacre that had to fit into sound bites and word limits, filled enough with statistics to counter measured response. And I perfected my English and I learned my UN resolutions. But still, he asked me, "Ms. Ziyada, don't you think everything would be resolved if you would just stop teaching so much hatred to your children?" Pause. I look inside of me for strength to be patient, but patience is not at the tip of my tongue as the bombs drop over Gaza. Patience has just escaped me. Pause. Smile. We teach life, sir. Rafif, remember to smile. Pause. We teach life, sir. We Palestinians teach life after they have occupied the last sky. We teach life after they have built their settlements and apartheid walls. After the last skies, we teach life, sir. But today, My body was a TV'd massacre made to fit into sound bites and word limits. And just give us a story, a human story. You see, this is not political. We just want to tell people about you and your people. So give us a human story. Don't mention that word apartheid and occupation. This is not political. You have to help me as a journalist to help you tell your story, which is not a political story. Today, my body was a TV'd massacre. How about you give us a story of a woman in Gaza who needs medication? How about you? Do you have enough bone, broken limbs to cover the sun? Hand me over your dead and give me the list of their names in 1,200 word limits. Today, my body was a TV'd massacre made to fit into sound bites and word limits and move those that are desensitized to terrorist blood. But they felt sorry. They felt sorry for the cattle over Gaza. So I give them UN resolutions and statistics, and we condemn and we deplore and we reject, and these are not two equal sides, occupier and occupied, and 100 dead, 200 dead, and 1,000 dead. And between that war crime and massacre, I vent out words and smile, not exotic, smile, not terrorist. And I recount 100 dead, 200 dead, 1,000 dead. Is anyone out there? Will anyone listen? I wish I could wail over their bodies. I wish I could just run barefoot in every refugee camp and hold every child, cover their ears so they wouldn't have to hear the sound of bombing for the rest of their life the way I do. Today, my body was a TV'd massacre, and let me just tell you, there is nothing your UN resolutions have ever done about this, and no soundbite I come up with, no matter how good my English gets, no soundbite will bring them back to life. No soundbite will fix this. We teach life, sir. We teach life, sir. We Palestinians wake up every morning to teach the rest of the world life, sir.
And we are back. Rafif Ziada is amazing, and she has a lot of amazing work. So I would encourage you to look into her because she is just absolutely phenomenal. So we're going to listen to a small piece by Noam Chomsky. He is a philosopher, he's a political activist, he's a professor in Harvard, Massachusetts, and another university. And he's just going to give his perspective on the Israel-Palestinian conflict. And I thought it was important to add this, as I am so biased in what I say, although I try not to be. It's going to give better perspective, in my opinion. It's just only a short 3-minute clip, and I feel like that will add a little bit of leverage to what I'm trying to convey.
Well, that's one of the most serious crises in the world. I mean, the United States and Israel are in grave violation of international humanitarian law. It's not my opinion, it's the opinion of the world's highest judicial authority, the International Court of Justice, which declared that the provisions of the Geneva Convention, Fourth Geneva Convention, apply to the occupied territories, which means that all movement of population into those areas, all the settlements, are illegal. The court determined authoritatively that the wall that Israel is building, which is clearly by now an annexation wall, is in ipso facto violation of international humanitarian law, insofar as it's there to protect settlers, which is maybe 80-85% of it. The Bush administration is the first one to have officially declared support for Israel's policies of takeover of what's valuable to it in the occupied territories, which makes the two countries in severe, and of course the U.S. funds it and provides the diplomatic and military support required for it. U.S. power centers appear to be pretty happy with this. U.S. corporations, for example, don't seem to object to having a highly militarized ally with a high technology very loyal because it has no choice once it decided to move towards, to prefer expansion to security as it did years ago. And they are certainly, technically they're capable of pursuing the policies that they are following. The major Arab states may not like it, but aren't going to try to do anything about it. The rest of Europe refuses to take more than a passive role. So that the Palestinians the nation is being destroyed. That's a rare event in history for a nation to face destruction, but it's happening. And it's happening. The United States and Israel at the moment are, and in fact for many years, have been internationally isolated in their refusal to accept a diplomatic settlement in accord with what has been an overwhelming international consensus, some kind of two-state settlement on the international border with some modification of borders, and they still are rejecting it alone. The Arab states have explicitly come out in favor of it. Iran has stated its agreement with the position of the Arab states. Hamas has called for it. Europe, of course, and the non-aligned countries, of course, but the U.S. has overwhelming power in that region. And if it stands in the way of a settlement, it won't take place with all the conflicts that this can lead to. And for the local populations, very serious, but even with ramifications elsewhere.
So we're just going to go back and highlight how dangerous the discourse and how alarming this discourse that is so commonly accepted today about Jewish homeland, a chosen people, and the concept of birthright. So just going back into doing a comparison of Zionism and Shadaism, imagine if under any other religion, and I use Islam because Muslims are always demonized and cast upon as this, as terrorists, as extremists. Imagine if I, in the name of Islam, decided to start a movement called Shadaism and go to a country that already had an existing population, draw my borders, eradicate people, displace hundreds of thousands of them, commit countless war crimes that under the UN there's hundreds of thousands of atrocities under the UN. And if you were to condemn me or critique me or criticize me in any manner, I would call you Islamophobic, and that you go against my existence as a Muslim or my existence as a human being. And it's this narrative cannot be accepted, and it's crazy. And the narrative of a chosen people is crazy. So we're just going to talk about people who have been critiqued in the media, who have had to lose their jobs. So the first one is Mark Lamont Hill. And he was a CNN reporter who had spoken about the Palestinian conflict, and he was fired from CNN. I don't have time to play what he said, but he basically just said that we want a free Palestine. We have Ilhan Omar, who is in the Democratic Party in the U.S., and she was demonized for her comments and made to apologize as being anti-Semitic. We have Angela Davis. Angela Davis, who is such a prominent activist from the 1960s, she speaks up for oppression. She's a writer, a scholar. She's one of my very, one of my role models. And she was stripped of an award due to being supportive of the Palestinian people. You have a teacher named Bahia Amawi. She's a speech pathologist in Texas. And she had to sign a contract saying that she would not boycott Israel. And she did not sign the contract, and she got fired as well. And first of all, that goes against your First Amendment rights as an American. Why should she have had to sign that in the first place? And it just goes to show how much control Israel has. We're in a country that is that loves to talk about its free speech and its rights and its, even when we talk about pro-life and pro-choice and guns and gun control and blah, 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 the government loves to say that we're so open to discourse and blah, 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 but then when it comes down to it, you're not down to having conflicting opinions and people expressing their personal autonomy and choosing not to support a different government. So that was just crazy to me. And I just wanted to highlight, when we're talking about birthright, which is a thing that has spread, especially in North America, where if you have any form of Jewish descent within you, you're able to take a trip that is paid for to Israel, and Israel is advertised to you, and it is something that is happening like among a lot of my friends. And I have a Canadian passport, so because of that privilege, I can enter Palestine. But if I carried my own Palestinian card, my own Palestinian refugee card, I would not be able to enter my own country, a country that my grandparents were born in, my great-grandparents were born in, the olive tree that has existed for centuries, if it's still there, we don't know, that just marks our existence in that country. And that was just so disheartening to hear that I can't even go back into my own country as a Palestinian, but anyone else could if they had, I think it was even a 16th of Jewish descent. So that was just completely just heartbreaking. And when we talk about critique of Israel, it is major human right violations. So when we're talking, when we say illegal settlements, that is dispelling people out of their homes, and they become refugees and they have nowhere to go. And it adds to the crisis that is happening with the 60 million and counting refugees worldwide. For me, it was always confusing growing up as to who I was, because my citizenship did not correlate with my ethnicity. And my ethnicity in the perspective of the world did not exist. And it was just kind of a fight of, no, I am Palestinian. I don't have papers. I don't have a passport. But that's all I've ever known, and that's all my family has ever known. And I think for Palestinians, it's very, very personal, because growing up, I was always told by my parents that you don't have a country to belong to. So wherever you are, make the most out of it. And I think it's very common now with diaspora children, or people who have conflict in their homes, and especially with post-Arab Spring, or countries like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Bangladesh even, Rwanda, Burma, just so many countries, is who are you in the worldview? In a country now, in a world where your citizenship and what your passport says dictates your privileges and your social hierarchy, it just starts to become frustrating. And I think with me, it was very difficult to accept that I was Canadian in a sense, because I felt that that would betray who I was as a Palestinian, and that would betray my people. But at the end of the day, you don't really have a choice, do you, when it comes to that? Where else do you go? You can't travel anywhere. You can't get accepted universities. There was if I'm not mistaken, it was called... there's a declaration that was made between Egypt and Palestinian and Israel that didn't allow Palestinians to go to university for a while. And my mom had grown up in that era, and she could not go to university, and she had to get married at 17 because there was nothing else to do. So it just, there's so much untold pain in what has happened, and not only to the people who are inside Palestine, which of course suffer much more, but to those outside as well. So when we're critiquing Israel, we have to realize that, number one, Gaza is completely barricaded. These people don't have electricity for, statistics are going to be completely, they're not going to be accurate, because we cannot get statistics within Gaza, because it is barricaded. But for most of the time, they don't have access to clean water, to electricity. Nothing comes in and out of Gaza. So that is fruit, that is medication, that is access to healthcare, that is meats, that is dairy, that is water. There are thousands of war crimes that are committed against civilians, and Israel is so militarized and so equipped with the latest technology that it is just sickening to see this, when they say that, oh, that was an accident. We bombed an entire family of 16 people by accident. We killed hundreds of civilians by accident. When if you look into the technology that they have, it is one of the most advanced stuff that is out there. Israeli weapons are tested on Palestinian people, and it is advertised as being tested before when they sell weaponry, and it's just sickening to me. They test on prisoners. Pharmaceutical companies test on prisoners. There has been multiple accounts of sterilization of Palestinian women. They imprison children, and there is documents and videotapes of that where women have had to go, or sorry, children have had to go to court and speak on their own behalf. There's torture that happens within prison systems. So it is, we are not critiquing, it is not anti-Semitic, we are not critiquing a Jewish existence. We are critiquing a colonizer oppressing the colonized. And when we talk about narrative as well, if we look into colonial theory, the colonized always casts a narrative on the colonizer casts a narrative on the colonized that they are less than. They dehumanize them. They make all the every action that they do seem radical and violent. And any uprising that happens within Palestine, any resistance, which is a natural resistance, think about you in any situation that you've been, where you've been oppressed, or you felt that you were treated unjustly. Think about your reaction to that, a normal human response. And that is always painted as terrorism, that we are violent, that we need to be controlled, we need to be occupied. And it just continues to legitimize it. So it's just tool upon tool upon tool. The security measures that are used, the surveillance measures that are used, the new citizenship. I'm not sure if it was in the IDF or in the government, had compared Palestinians as being illegal immigrants as when he was talking about Trump's wall, and he compared them to being similar to Mexicans, which I have my own entire perspective on that, but how are we immigrants to a country that we were born in? And this narrative is accepted, and it's disheartening, and it's so hurtful. I don't want to bring emotion into this because I'd like to talk about it in a kind of clear-headed way, but it is just extremely disheartening to read and see and have your people consistently vilified. Just to end today's discussion, what is the solution to the conflict? And I'm not going to talk about a two-state or a one-state solution, because when we talk about two-state solutions, that casts the light that it is an equal fight, that it is binary. When we say two-state, that means the Palestinian side has as much power as the Israeli side, and it's 50-50. When in logic and in reality, it's 99.1% in terms of power. So we cannot discuss two-state solutions when there is such an imbalance in power between the two. We can't discuss two-state solutions when one is militarized and equipped and has surveillance on every branch of the territory, and one barely has the supplies and equipment to sustain itself for the next day. We cannot talk about two-state solutions when one continues to commit atrocious human rights violations every single day. Don't come to me about a two-state solution and that the Palestinian side is violent and they are, in some cases, terrorist groups within it, when they are just reacting to oppression. So it's laughable and disheartening to come and talk about a two-state solution or a ceasefire. A ceasefire from what? What do the Palestinian people even have to use? And it is all a response. So it isn't two ways. It is completely, one is on the defense and one is on the offense. So we need to look into the settler colonial institution that Israel is set up on. We need to look at the apartheid laws and how they mirror South Africa. We need to disentangle. One second, please. We'll just wrap this up because someone else has their turn to go on. But we need to disentangle the institution in which it is built. We need to stop supplying Israel with the billions of dollars that it gets from multiple states around the world. We need to stop supplying the military. If you truly want peace, and we'll look at this from an from a realistic perspective or an idealistic perspective or even a liberal one, if you truly want peace, why do you continue to supply your military? Why do you continue to pump billions of dollars into weapons, into prison systems, into illegal settlements? If you truly want peace, that isn't the response that you would take, and that isn't the approach that you would take. So we have to first look into that. We have to first talk about the fact that it exists as a colonial state in the beginning. We have to talk about the moral implications that it puts on our world today. We cannot sit in Canada and the United States and condemn the years of colonialism and the colonialism that still exists against Indigenous people and say that we apologize for our dark past and our dark history and then continue to support a state that does the exact same thing. It is, I'm going to say the word disheartening for the 10th time today. But it is disheartening and it is hypocritical too. I can't take you seriously if you're gonna tell me I don't believe in colonialism and I would like to apologize for all of it and then turn a blind eye and take a trip to Israel or support a trip to Israel. So when we talk about the BDS movement, which is boycott, divest, sanctions, and we say that is anti-Semitic, it is not anti-Semitic. Speaking out and criticizing Israel and Zionism is not anti-Semitic, and I will never, ever, ever apologize for speaking out on the Palestinian people, and I will never allow this narrative of anti-Semitism control me and control the things I have to say. And I would just like to end with a positive note. I will play a positive song, and I'm going to play Nas's I Can. Oh, actually, I will love to play, it's called Ali Al-Kufiya, and it's by Muhammad Asaf, and he's from Gaza. And he's a Palestinian singer, and Ali Al-Kufiya. Kufiya is the scarf that has become so fashionable these days. And it has kind of these, it's white, or it could be red, and it has black lines run down in a grid manner. And it is a Palestinian kind of historical, it has historical reference, and now a lot of people in Palestinian movements wear it. And a lot of times they wear it in Palestine to protect from gas, gas bombs and other things. So we're going to put on Ali Al-Kufiya, and I'm going to come back with a very hopeful message, because although things may seem dark, they are not dark, because we have the power to change things, and I'm a very firm believer that no matter how dark things get, life will find its way to be happier. That sounded so preachy. I apologize for that. But we're going to put Ali Al-Kufiya and we'll be back with the final note. So, thank you. So, we are back and I would just like to summarize again. I think summaries are very important. They reinforce ideas they reinforce the important ideas. I used to always love those projects that my teachers would give me. If it was a summary, I'd be like, oh my god, I love this. Just to reiterate and end this thing on a positive note, the narrative that critiquing or criticizing Israel as anti-Semitic is false, because it is not an ethnic conflict or a religious conflict. It is not Arabs versus Jews. It is settler colonialism, and it is apartheid. So we're fighting oppression and not fighting an ethnic fight. So one, I don't be frightened by this narrative of anti-Semitic. It is just there to silence you and take away from the actual issue that is going on, and that is Israel's committing countless human rights violations. Gaza's completely barricaded. They test pharmaceuticals on prisoners. They imprison children. They sterilize Palestinian women. And it's that's don't let that take away from the actual issue. And I would just like to end that when Palestinians speak out, or people of minority in general speak out, or when women speak out, when people ask you, why are you so angry, just tell them that we have a right to be angry. Have you seen the world in the manner that it is today? Why are you not as angry as I am, is my question to you. Please put your emotions into something productive and do something with your life. We have a right to be angry, but directed anger, put that into something healthy, and I would just like to say, let us all just try and be better human beings. Let's just be better human beings, and thank you, and we will be back next week, and we'll be discussing white privilege, something that is also very touchy, sensitive, and feely, but again, I do not apologize for anything that I have to say, but I do encourage healthy discourse. So if you disagree with me, I would love to hear why. There's nothing in the world, which is kind of weird, that gives me like a kind of rush than having these kind of debates and healthy discussions, because please tell me why you disagree. And we could reach somewhere in the middle, we could not, or I could agree with you. So good night, good afternoon, and we will see you all next week. I will leave you with, there is a track that is supposed to be playing in the background, but it is loading. So in the meantime, while this track is loading, I will be talking. And what is that thing that people listen to on YouTube when people whisper into microphones? What is that called?
ASMR. Okay, we're actually back. So
let me choose a song, and I will open a playlist. Ooh, what playlist do we have over here? Okay, I will leave you back with What Are You Waiting For?